Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, are you an optimist or a pessimist when it comes to whether you think you're going to benefit or be harmed by a test or treatment? If you're exercising to maintain a flat tummy, which activity is best? Strength training or aerobic exercise? The answer isn't necessarily what you'd expect and is different from the best exercise for weight loss. And a remarkable study which has found there isn't a single test which can tell you what age you are. The researchers started from the premise that what we've thought of as the inevitable consequences of ageing haven't much to do with ageing at all, but are the result of deterioration due to physical inactivity. Steve Harridge is Professor of Human Physiology at King's College London.
Yes, that was exactly the premise behind the study. We know that physical activity is absolutely crucial to your whole body physiology and to health throughout the lifespan. And if you're physically inactive, that's bad for you at any age. So if we're trying to assume that changes in the body are occurring as a result of the aging process, and we want to study the biology of that, who do we study? And our premise was that to study the underlying aging signal, what we had to do is study people who weren't contaminated by the other factors which are bad for your physiology and bad for your health.
In other words, how do you remove inactivity from the equation to see what truly is aging?
Exactly. You've got, obviously, smoking, maybe drinking, poor nutrition, but physical inactivity is the one thing that gets left out of a lot of studies of ageing. So what we were trying to do with this study is remove that inactivity component. So if we study people of different ages and we see differences in their function, but they're all very active, undertaking the same type of activity, undertaking a lot of physical activity, then the effect we'll be seeing, we hypothesise, would be the underlying ageing process.
Suddenly ageing would become visible.
Exactly.
So you took these cyclists. Tell me about them.
The cyclists were all amateur road cyclists. They had to be able to cycle 100 kilometres in 6.5 hours if you're a male, or 60 kilometres in 5.5 hours if you're a female. The males were training on average about 750 kilometres a month. And the reason we sort of set that was we actually don't know how much exercise do you need to do to be able to just age inherently. So we set a value that was actually rather high, so it would be well above any value.
You wanted to get beyond the statistical noise.
We did. Now, the reason we studied cyclists, and cycling is a great activity, you know, it's low impact, a lot of people are doing it, it really challenges the large muscle masses, and it's great for the cardiovascular respiratory system. And particularly, you know, here in the UK, you don't have to cycle very far to realise just how hilly this country is. And they're also doing the same kind of activity.
And all having the same cup of coffee on a Sunday morning in their tight lycra.
Exactly. But they weren't elite athletes, that was the point.
And the age between 55 and nearly 80.
That's right. That age we chose for a variety of reasons, partly because it crosses the boundary of late working life through to sort of retirement. And obviously that's becoming more and more important. We need to know more about how the body ages as the working population is having to work for longer and to be healthier for longer.
And what did you measure? You measured a whole series of things to see whether or not there was a test which picked up this ageing signal. What did you measure?
One of the sort of sub-questions of the study is what could we measure that would actually predict the age of an individual once we'd actually got rid of the noise of inactivity?
Was there a test which would tell you somebody was 55 or another person was 79?
Exactly. We set up about measuring a whole portfolio, a wide range of physiological indices. So they came to our laboratory for 2 days of testing. We measured their exercise capacity in terms of the maximal rate at which they can consume oxygen, which is your VO2 max. It's kind of the gold standard of physical fitness. We measured their balance, their muscle strength, their muscle power, their lung function. We took blood samples to look at various metabolic and hormonal markers. We looked at cognitive function. We performed DEXA scanning to measure bone density and body composition. So a real wide range of measures. And the interesting thing was that whilst some of these parameters correlated with age, in fact, our best predictor of age, although still not a great one, was actually the level of your aerobic fitness, this VO2 max. But even here, the interesting observation was that the range of functional values could actually incorporate a wide age range. So in fact, you could have a value and be 55 years of age or be 75 years of age. So it actually incorporated a large age range, and we found this for many functions.
So even though there was a bit of a decline, it still didn't pick what age you were?
We're not saying that there's not a decline in age with age. Of course, there is. But actually, even these very sort of homogeneous individuals, there's a lot of noise about that signal. So it actually makes it very difficult to pick out the age of an individual. And that's likely related to, you know, genetic differences between people. We know even at a young age, people are very different. So what we really want to do next is remove that genetic effect by studying the same individual over time and measuring each person in 5 years' time so that we can track in a longitudinal fashion the effects of aging. Again, the idea being that if they are still exercising in 5 or 10 years' time, if we see a decline, that decline will be due to the aging process and not due to physical inactivity.
So let's just be clear. On average, the things that you were measuring did decline a bit with age. But where are you finding 79-year-olds who didn't show much decline and were, to all intents and purposes, looked the same as a 55-year-old?
Well, they do in this cross-sectional design. So what we don't know from this, the design of the study, if we took a 55-year-old and measured him when he was 75, would he show no decline? Or are we just looking at the inherent genetic differences between people?
So does physical activity keep you young? Which is really the other part of that question.
It's a good question. Not so much does it keep you young. Our study set out with the idea of looking at the optimal aging effect. In these individuals, we're saying these people are aging optimally. Now, compared to people of the same age who are sedentary, their levels of function are far superior, which by that criteria makes them younger. But that's not to say that they're not aging. They are aging, but these individuals are, we would argue, are aging optimally. But if you're inactive, you're not aging optimally. And therefore, your level of function is going to be worse and make you appear older compared to the active individuals.
Now, you picked physical inactivity as an issue here, almost in an evolutionary sense.
Yeah.
But nutrition is also important here. If you talk to people who train rugby players or football players or hockey players, tennis players, you know, there is some evidence that changing your nutritional state changes, you know, the way your muscles work and the fitness of your body. To what extent did the nutrition vary among these cyclists?
Well, these individuals, we did study and record their nutritional habits, and generally speaking, they're all eating quite healthy diets. I think there's a balance between the nutritional camp and the exercise camp. I suspect both are important, but I think physical inactivity has got in a lower profile than it should have in this whole area of health. I think the key thing is the physical activity. The point being with these individuals, you have to eat well. You're not going to be able to maintain the cycling training loads that these people were doing without eating well. And we know that in many sedentary and frailer older people, they are not eating well, that's for sure. So for overall health, an older person should certainly look to optimize their nutrition, having a well-balanced mixed diet. But that's not enough. That needs to be combined with a physical activity program.
And there's this tantalizing research really from Canada initially, which suggests that, so that there is a theory that these energy-producing elements in cells called mitochondria are part of the aging process. And if you exercise, it almost renews your muscle mitochondria and makes your muscles young again. Did you do muscle biopsies on these people?
We have taken muscle biopsies of these people, and we haven't yet analyzed their mitochondria. We've analyzed some other aspects of their muscles, which are very interesting. That is, one of the key features of aging muscle, at least in sedentary people, is the muscles get smaller, a process known as sarcopenia. And that relates quite closely to a reduction in size, an atrophy of your type 2 muscle fibers. Now, your type 2 muscle fibers are effectively your fast-twitch muscles. Your type 1s are your slow-twitch muscles. And it's the type 2, your fast-twitch muscles, which give you the power. In most aging studies that we see, they report a reduction in the size of your type 2 muscle fibers. We don't see any relationship between age and the size of the type 2 muscle fibers in this study, which again suggests what we're going to be dealing with here is a disuse phenomena when we look at many of the sedentary studies, because in these highly active individuals, they seem to be maintaining their type 2 fiber size, which partly explains why they're able to maintain such good muscle function.
And for those people listening who are allergic to Lycra and Sunday morning in the coffee shop showing off your wares, you still don't really know what the dose is for optimal ageing.
We don't know what the dose is. And whilst we've studied cyclists, the key point is not so much cycling, but being physically active. And interestingly, many of the cyclists had actually been runners earlier in their lives, had found the wear and tear on their knees rather stressful and had moved to a more of a low-impact sport such as cycling. Now, that's not to say that running's not good for you. Going to the gym and lifting weights, particularly if you're looking to build muscle specifically, is probably the best exercise you can do. Interestingly, when we looked, for example, at our bone mineral density of these cyclists, because we studied males as well as females, we had to actually refer some of the females back to their GPs because we diagnosed them as being osteoporotic.
Because they weren't weight-bearing.
Exactly. It's not the optimal type of exercise for your bone because it's really unloading. The bone is just sitting there thinking it's doing nothing. It's ignorant of the fact that the rest of your body is working very hard. So if you're looking to create a program of optimal health, you probably want to include activities that challenge the different systems. So a bit of running is good, a bit of cycling is good, a bit of swimming is good, a bit of going to the gym and lifting some weights is good. You really want to mix it up a bit.
Steve Harridge is Professor of Human Physiology at King's College London. And hopefully you're listening to this health report at the gym, brain and brawn. You're on Radio National and I'm Norman Swan. If, like me, your focus when you're trying to lose weight is on getting rid of that belly that's shaped more like a bottle of Pinot Noir than a six-pack, you might wonder, apart from controlling what you eat, what's the best exercise? That's what Rania Makkari and her colleagues set out to discover. Rania is at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Boston.
You know, there are two types of exercises, the aerobic exercise and there is the anaerobic exercise. And when you engage in aerobic activities such as jogging, running, swimming and whatnot, your major source of energy is coming from fat, because fat can only be burned aerobically with the presence of oxygen. It's not 100% fat, but mostly fat, as well as glycogen, some.
And just to explain, glycogen is a storage carbohydrate, largely in your liver, which can pull down and get quick energy when you need it.
Exactly. And the other type of workout is the anaerobic workout, such as the resistance training, which is meaning without the presence of oxygen. You're exerting a certain movement on the muscle above what the muscle can normally do. The source of energy for that type of exercise is mostly glycogen and not fat, because fat doesn't have a choice to be burned but with the presence of oxygen. Glycogen, on the other hand, could be burned with or without the presence of oxygen. So that's why when you do anaerobic activity, your source of energy is really glycogen. So that being said, this begs the question, how come we got those results? Why is weight training inversely associated with the decrease in waist circumference?
You've given away the punchline, but just tell me about the research that you did and the question that you asked for the research.
We wanted to compare different types of physical activities in relation to waist circumference and body weight. But we wanted to focus on waist circumference because, do you want to know why? I don't know if you want to know why.
Of course I want to know why. Because it's the most significant risk factor for heart disease and diabetes.
Exactly. And especially as we increase in age, there is sarcopenia, which is loss of skeletal muscle mass. And as a result, there is accumulation of fat mass. Therefore, when you weigh yourself on a scale, your body weight might show a slight decrease and then you might think you're doing good. But in fact, no, this is not a good surrogate measure for health. You should rely on waist circumference, which is a better measure because it measures the visceral fat or the abdominal fat mass around your waist. So we wanted to look at the different types of exercises, moderate to vigorous aerobic activities versus weight training in relation to waist circumference change as well as body weight change. Among men, healthy men of all BMI range, so they could be, you know, normal weight, overweight, obese, all men, or when they replace one type for the other, what happens?
So this is a period of over 12 years you looked at this?
Yes, we looked at 12 years follow-up.
So what did you find?
When we compared the different activities, 20 minutes of moderate vigorous aerobic activities versus weight training, we found that 20 minutes per day of weight training was the most strongly associated with the waist circumference change, meaning as we age, there is an inevitable increase in waist circumference. So people who engaged in weight training, they were lessening that increase. They were lessening it more as compared to those who did engage in other types of physical activities. Also, those who combined both types of activities saw the most ideal results. So I'm not trying to discredit the health benefits of aerobic activities. No, I'm just saying that it is not enough by itself as we increase in age. You need to add strength training, weight training. The other thing is we also compared replacing replacing 20 minutes per day of weight instead of 20 minutes per day of aerobic activities, and we saw a very strong association, a favorable one, with waist circumference change, meaning it's really good if you replace weight training instead of aerobic activities, whereas the other way around didn't work. If you replace aerobic activities for weight training equal time, it did not show a favorable response in waist circumference.
So, and just to be clear, those who did both, which is what the current recommendation is in both Australia in the United States, they had the best benefit.
Right. Exactly. And then we looked at those who did no weight training versus those who did less than 25 minutes per day of weight training versus those who did more than 25 minutes per day of weight training. And the take-home message was men who engaged in more than 25 minutes per day of weight training, adding on top of that the aerobic activities, did not lead to any further benefit as far as waist circumference. So really, you're in a very good shape. If you don't like aerobic activities, you're really in a very good shape if you do at least minimum 25 minutes per day of weight training. That's what we saw. You see what I mean? If you do less, then it's good to combine with aerobic activities as well to get the most benefit.
So given your story at the beginning, which was about the burning of fat, and that one of the reasons that you look at waist circumference is because of this toxic fat around your intestines, the visceral fat, why should weight training lessen the increase in waist circumference as we age?
Yeah, excellent question. A few things are happening because we looked at long-term. So we're not talking about 1 month. We're talking about 6 months and more, you know, long-term follow-up. What will happen over time, your muscles, upon engaging in weight training, will adapt. You will have more mitochondria in the muscles, and the mitochondria are the organs responsible for lipid oxidation.
Energy factories inside cells.
Exactly. That leads to the ATP, which is the source of energy for the muscles to be able to move. So when you have more mitochondria in the muscle, that means automatically you're able to oxidize or burn more lipids or fat. That means, in lay terms, you're really able to get the benefits of the aerobic workout while engaging in the anaerobic workout.
And indeed, anybody who does weight training knows that there are some weight training exercises which get you out of breath.
Oh, yeah.
You run out of puff. So they are actually both aerobic and anaerobic at the same time.
Precisely. It's certainly a mixture, of course. So adaptation was one thing. There was another justification. When you engage in weight training, studies have found that the energy expenditure increases not only in between sets, because you do a set of exercise and then you take a little rest and then a set. It increases not only in between sets, but also 48 hours post the weight training workout. So think about that, meaning if you compare someone who engaged in 20 minutes per day of weight training versus someone who did not, that other person who did the weight training, he's burning more calories during the weight training and also 2 days after. So you're going to maintain the muscle mass, the fat mass will be less, you're burning more calories, and that's what happens. So all these mechanisms happening at the same time.
And is there a particular weight training that works better than others?
In the paper, we didn't look at that, so I don't want to say that my answer is from the paper, but this is from my own knowledge because I also train fitness on the side. I teach different things. You want to do something balanced for the whole body, so you don't want to do a lower and neglect the upper or vice versa, right? So you want to target all the muscles in the group. You know, if you do it right with the right weight, because everybody has a different muscle strength. So if you do it with the right weights and gradually the right amount of sets and reps, then you should be all set.
Where does nutrition fit into this? Did you look at the nutrition of these people versus their waist circumference before we even talk about weight loss?
We looked at the protein intake. We compared men who took a lot of, like, more than the median of protein versus lower than the median in that sample. We saw a stronger association among men who consumed a little bit higher than the median. I can't remember what the median was on that sample, but it was higher, like in the high intake of dietary protein. So we saw more benefit.
And what about weight loss? What happened to their weight compared to the types of training?
Moderate to vigorous aerobic activities, this is the type of activity that was the strongest associated with body weight change and not weight training. which is because muscles weigh more than fat. So when you do weight training the right way, you're maintaining your muscle mass. So if you're going to weigh yourself on the scale, you might be upset, oh, I'm not losing weight. But you don't want to lose the muscle mass. Yeah, of course it's not going to change that much. You should really measure your waist circumference. So we did see that moderate to vigorous aerobic activities, it leads to the strongest lessening of body weight increase. But that's not very interesting to us because we don't want that.
Just finally, answer me a question that listeners often ask me. Norman, I want to lose weight. I want to get fitter. What's the yin and yang of fat and muscle when it comes to weight loss? Is there an equation here? So if I lose 6 kilos and I'm training at the same time, what's the story? For every kilo of fat that I lose, you know, and you put on muscle, is there a story here that we know?
Yeah, every kilo you lose or you gain, in general, it's going to be 75% fat, 25% muscle. And also if you lose, however, you could change those percentages by engaging in the right type of physical activity, such as weight training, and then eating the right diet, such as protein, so that you're really adding on muscle mass and not fat mass when you add each kilo.
So crudely, you could be losing less weight by about 25%, potentially, if you're involved in weight training while you're trying to lose weight, but your waist circumference would go down. So in other words, you would be 25% more disappointed with your weight loss, but it's because you're putting on muscle.
Exactly.
So, Rani, have you got any tips for somebody who's willing to do weight training for 20 minutes a day, what they should be doing?
Yeah, I mean, they could be efficient, and rather than taking rest periods in between sets, they could do, for example, a set of upper body workout, and then they could alternate with either abs workout or lower body, and then they go upper, lower. So they're really doing a 40-minute workout into 20-minute workout. Because they're not taking a rest. They're resting their muscles, but they're working on a different muscle group. That's just my advice. That's what I do to myself.
You're a masochist. And I take it that interval training, high-intensity interval training, postdates this study, and you're not able to comment on that.
No, this is not from the study. Again, I cannot comment on it. You're right.
Rana Makari, a tough-sounding trainer. She's at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Boston. Many people, certainly not everyone, like the idea of sharing decisions about suggested treatments or tests with their doctor or health professional. But making a rational choice depends on lots of things, including the available evidence, but also the subjective perception of the balance of benefits versus harms. Two experts in shared decision-making, Chris Del Mar and Tammy Hoffman at Bond University and the University of Queensland, decided to look for what other researchers had found were patients' beliefs about the benefits and harms of clinical care, such as tests, screening and treatments. To do that, they had to look through a mind-boggling 12,000 scientific papers. Chris Del Mar.
We found that overall, people overestimate the benefits of clinical management and underestimate the harms of it.
To what extent, Tammy?
Well, we weren't able to actually put a size on it. All we could identify was that it's more than half of the people answering the questions thought that they were going to get more benefit from the intervention than the evidence suggests they will, or that they would get less harm than what the evidence suggests they will.
So did you calibrate this against what they were told before they had the treatment or test?
So what we actually were interested in this study was people's natural expectations. So we actually wanted them uninfluenced or unbiased by anything a clinician had specifically told them.
Chris, give me some tangible examples of where expectations can be really out of kilter with what the real situation is.
There were a lot of studies done on cancer screening. This was the area in which people more likely overestimated the benefits and more likely underestimated the harms. Breast cancer screening, cervical cancer screening, bowel cancer screening, and prostate cancer screening.
What do we know are the dimensions of the benefits versus harms?
The reality is that there are benefits for screening for most cancers. There's some doubt about prostate cancer. The harms have been less well documented, things like unnecessary operations and, more subtly, unnecessary labels. In other words, we detect a lot of people with cancers who may never have been bothered by those cancers throughout their whole life, but who then have to live their life with this horrible, you know, the label of cancer. And that harm has been much more difficult to balance out.
And Tammy, I assume the unreasonable expectation here is, if you're going to choose breast cancer, is that you will never die of breast cancer if you screen.
That's right. So people thought that the proportion of breast cancers that would be detected by screening was much, much, much higher than it really was.
And treatments, Chris?
Inflammatory bowel disease, that's Crohn's disease and the like. Hip replacements, joint replacements. Again, people got overestimates of the benefits of that. And then some of the cardiovascular disease things. So one of them was being resuscitated if you had a cardiac arrest.
So people were more optimistic than the actual outcomes?
Yeah, the outcomes aren't awfully good.
So this is really people's expectations walking into the clinic. Do we know anything right about what influences people to make a more rational decision?
Well, obviously, if you want people to know the correct information, you've got to tell them. We didn't do an assessment of how effective this educational stuff was, but it makes us realise that for any clinician, it's really important that you appreciate that the patient coming in for your particular form of clinical management probably overestimates the benefits and underestimates the harms of what it is that you're about to propose. And so it then falls on your responsibility to make sure that they are adequately informed, something that we often take for granted. We kind of assume that people know, even with really simple things like using antibiotics for an upper respiratory infection, we kind of assume that people have some idea of the pros and cons. This couldn't be further from the truth.
And presumably then, if you're having a hip replacement, knowing that the rehabilitation path might be a bit tougher than you imagine.
Absolutely. We have to be very careful not to oversell what we're proposing.
So what would be the implications for the health system and individuals if expectations were more realistic going into having such tests and treatments? I mean, would people choose not to have them?
Yes. For example, with prostate cancer screening, once people are fully informed, a lot of men say, I don't think I want this test. And that's probably true of a lot of other interventions as well. That actually causes a problem for some clinicians. So, for example, I know of some breast cancer physicians who are very keen to promote breast cancer screening, are very worried about telling people about the realities of what happens. They say to me, but then few people will come and get screened and some people will die as a consequence. And that's probably true. But we need to actually make sure that it's the patient that decides that and not us in some paternalistic frame of mind. Shared decision making is the process of explaining to patients what the options are, the pros and cons of each of those options, and then helping the decision be shared between both clinician and patient together.
There seems to be, from a lot of the studies that we read, this vicious cycle happens where a lot of times patients go into a consultation with a particular expectation of receiving a certain intervention, and that clinicians often prescribe or give that intervention purely because of the expectation. So there's some studies in the US showing that up to a third of clinicians report providing an intervention purely because the patient requested it, not because they believed it was clinically necessary. So when that happens, you get this feedback cycle where the patient receives the intervention, reinforcing their belief that it was necessary in the first place, and on it goes. So breaking that cycle, either by the clinician explaining the evidence for the intervention or the patient asking, what is the likelihood of me getting benefit or harm from this? Otherwise, it's just going to keep perpetuating itself.
Tammy Hoffman is a clinical epidemiologist at Bond University and the University of Queensland, and Chris Del Mar is Professor of Public Health at Bond University. And you can find a reference for that paper on the Health Report's website. And you have been listening to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Next week, some great stories about your heart and the differences between men and women. Don't miss it, and I'll see you then.